The Admirable Crichton, a comedy. Act 1, at Loam House, Mayfair. A moment before the curtain rises, the Honorable Ernest Woolley drives up to the door of Loam House in Mayfair. There is a happy smile on his pleasant, insignificant face, and this presumably means that he is thinking of himself. He is too busy over nothing, this man about town, to be always thinking of himself, but on the other hand, he almost never thinks of any other person. Probably Ernest's great moment is when he wakes of a morning and realizes that he really is Ernest, for we must all wish to be that which is our ideal. We can conceive him springing out of bed lightheartedly and waiting for his man to do the rest. He is dressed in excellent taste, with just the little bit more, which shows that he is not without a sense of humor. The dandiacal are often saved by carrying a smile at the whole thing in their spats, let us say. Ernest left Cambridge the other day, a member of the Athenaeum, which he would be sorry to have you confound with a club in London of the same name. He is a bachelor, but not of arts, no mean epigrammatist, as you shall see, and a favorite of the ladies. He is almost a celebrity in restaurants, where he dines frequently, returning to sup, and during this last year he has probably paid as much in them for the privilege of handing his hat to an attendant as the rent of a working man's flat. He complains brightly that he is hard up, and that if somebody or other at Westminster does not look out, the country will go to the dogs. He is no fool. He has the shrewdness to float with the current, because it is a labor-saving process. But he has sufficient pluck to fight, if fight he must. A brief contest, for he would soon be toppled over. He has a light nature, which enables him to bob up cheerily in new conditions and return unaltered to the old ones. His selfishness is his most endearing quality. If he has his way, he will spend his life like a cat in pushing his betters out of the soft places, and until he is old, he will be fondled in the process. He gives his hat to one footman and his cane to another and mounts the great staircase unassisted and undirected. As a nephew of the house, he need show no credentials even to Crichton, who is guarding a door above. It would not be good taste to describe Crichton, who is only a servant. If, to the scandal of all good houses, he is to stand out as a figure in the play, he must do it on his own, as they say, in the pantry and the boudoir. We are not going to help him. We have had misgivings ever since we found his name in the title, and we shall keep him out of his rights as long as we can. Even though we soften to him, he would not be a hero in these clothes of servitude. And he loves his clothes. How to get him out of them? It would require a cataclysm. To be an indoor servant at all is to Crichton a badge of honor. To be a butler at 30 is the realization of his proudest ambitions. He is devotedly attached to his master, who, in his opinion, has but one fault. He is not sufficiently contemptuous of his inferiors. We are immediately to be introduced to this solitary failing of a great English peer. This perfect butler, then, opens a door and ushers Ernest into a certain room. At the same moment, the curtain rises on this room, and the play begins. It is one of several reception rooms in Loam House, not the most magnificent, but quite the softest. And of a warm afternoon, all that those who are anybody crave for is the softest. The larger rooms are magnificent and bare, carpetless, so that it is an accomplishment to keep one's feet on them. They are sometimes lent for charitable purposes. They are also all in use on the night of a dinner party, when you may find yourself alone in one, having taken a wrong turning, or alone, save for two others who are within hailing distance. This room, however, is comparatively small and very soft. There are so many cushions in it that you wonder why, if you are an outsider and don't know, that it needs six cushions to make one fair head comfy. The couches themselves are cushions as large as beds, and there is an art of sinking into them and of waiting to be helped out of them. There are several famous paintings on the walls, of which you may say, "Jolly thing, that," without losing caste as knowing too much, and in cases there are glorious miniatures, but the daughters of the house cannot tell you of whom. There is a catalogue somewhere. There are 1,000 or so of roses in basins, several library novels, and a row of weekly illustrated newspapers lying against each other like fallen soldiers. If anyone disturbs this row, Crichton seems to know of it from afar and appears noiselessly and replaces the wanderer. One thing unexpected in such a room is a great array of tea things. Ernest spots them with a twinkle and has his epigram at once unsheathed. He dallies, however, before delivering the thrust.
I perceive from the teacups, Crichton, that the great function is to take place here.
Yes, sir.
The servants' hall coming up to have tea in the drawing room. No wonder you look happy, Crichton.
No, sir.
Do you know, Crichton, I think that with an effort you might look even happier. You don't approve of his lordship's compelling his servants to be his equals once a month?
It is not for me, sir, to disapprove of his lordship's radical views.
Certainly not. And, after all, it is only once a month that he is affable to you.
On all other days of the month, sir, his lordship's treatment of us is everything that could be desired.
Teacups, life, Crichton, is like a cup of tea. The more heartily we drink, the sooner we reach the dregs.
Thank you, sir.
Crichton, in case I should be asked to say a few words to the servants, I have strung together a little speech. I was wondering where I should stand.
Ernest tries various places and postures, and comes to rest leaning over a high chair, whence in dumb show he addresses a gathering. Crichton, with the best intentions, gives him a footstool to stand on, and departs, happily unconscious that Ernest, in some dudgeon, has kicked the footstool across the room before addressing an imaginary audience.
Suppose you were all little fishes at the bottom of the sea.
Ernest is not quite satisfied with his position, though sure that the fault must lie with the chair for being too high, not with him for being too short. Crichton's suggestion was not perhaps a bad one after all. He lifts the stool, but hastily conceals it behind him on the entrance of the ladies Catherine and Agatha, two daughters of the house. Catherine is 20, and Agatha 2 years younger. They are very fashionable young women indeed, who might wake up for a dance, but they are very lazy. Catherine being 2 years lazier than Agatha.
And how are my little friends today?
Don't be silly, Ernest. If you want to know how we are dead. Even to think of entertaining the servants is so exhausting.
Besides which, we have had to decide what frocks to take with us on the yacht, and that is such a mental strain.
You poor, overworked things. Rest your weary limbs.
Evidently, Agatha is Ernest's favorite, for he helps her to put her feet on the settee, while Catherine has to dispose of her own feet. So perhaps in revenge...
But why have you a footstool in your hand?
Yes.
Why? You see, as the servants are to be the guest, I must be the butler. I was practicing. This is a tray. Observe.
Holding the footstool as a tray, he minces across the room like an accomplished footman. The gods favor him, for just here, Lady Mary enters, and he holds out the footstool to her.
Tea, my lady.
Lady Mary is a beautiful creature of 22, and is of a natural hauteur, which is at once the fury and the envy of her sisters. If she chooses, she can make you seem so insignificant that you feel you might be swept away with the crumb brush. She seldom chooses because of the trouble of preening herself as she does it. She is usually content to show that you merely tire her eyes. She often seems to be about to go to sleep in the middle of a remark. There is quite a long and anxious pause, and then she continues, like a clock that hesitates, bored, in the middle of a strike.
It is only you, Ernest. I thought there was someone here.
She bestows herself on cushions.
Had a very tiring day also, Mary?
Dreadfully. Been trying on engagement rings all the morning.
What's that? Is it Brocklehurst?
The energetic Agatha nods.
You have given your warm young heart to Brocky?
Lady Mary is impervious to Ernest's humor, but he continues bravely.
I don't wish to fatigue you, Mary, by insisting on a verbal answer, but if, without straining yourself, you can signify yes or no, won't you make the effort?
She indolently flashes a ring on her most important finger, and he starts back melodramatically.
The ring! Then I am too late! Too late! May I ask, Mary, does Brocky know? Of course, it was that terrible mother of his who pulled this through. Mother does everything for Brocky. Still, in the eyes of the law, you will be not her wife, but his. And, therefore, I hold that Brocky ought to be informed. Now,
Ernest discovers that the lady's languorous eyes have closed.
If you girls are shamming sleep in the expectation that I shall awaken you in the manner beloved of ladies, abandon all such hopes.
Catherine and Agatha look up without speaking. Lady Mary speaks without looking up.
You impertinent boy.
I knew that was it, though I don't know everything, Agatha. I'm not young enough to know everything.
Ernest looks hopefully from one to another, but though they try to grasp his latest epigram, his brilliance baffles them. Agatha is Ernest's secret admirer.
Young enough?
Don't you see? I'm not young enough to know everything.
I'm sure it's awfully clever, but it's so puzzling.
Here Crichton ushers in an athletic, pleasant-faced young clergyman, Mr. Treherne, who greets the company.
Ernest, say it to Mr. Treherne.
Look here, Treherne. I'm not young enough to know everything.
How do you mean, Ernest?
I mean what I say.
Say it again. Say it more slowly.
I'm not young enough to know everything.
I see. What you really mean, my boy, is that you are not old enough to know everything.
No, I don't.
I assure you that's it.
Of course it is.
Yes, Ernest, that's it.
I am not young enough, Crichton, to know everything.
It is an anxious moment, but a smile is at length extorted from Crichton as with a corkscrew.
Thank you, sir.
Crichton goes.
Ah. If you had that fellow's head, Treherne, you would find something better to do with it than play cricket. I hear you bowl with your head.
I'm afraid cricket is all I'm good for, Ernest.
Indeed it isn't. You are sure to get on, Mr. Treherne.
Thank you, Lady Catherine.
But it was the bishop who told me so. He said a clergyman who breaks both ways is sure to get on in England.
Oh, I'm jolly glad.